Hey, superfans. This is Brenda Strong. I play Lillian Luthor on Supergirl, and you're listening to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life.
Hey there, podcast peeps. Welcome to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. I'm your host, Joe Stuber. It's 2018. It's the 80th anniversary year of Superman. And I promised you more super guests this year than you can handle. There's a lot coming your way. I've got a few coming your way in the weeks ahead before we kick off Flash Month in February. Now, you folks out there know, if you've been listening to the show for any length of time, I celebrate anniversaries all year long here on the show. A lot of big ones for Superman coming up. Superman's 80th this year. First appearance in Action Comics, number one. Superman the movie's 40th anniversary. That's coming up. 30th anniversary for the Superboy television series. Yeah, we are celebrating in super style this year. So many guests. I'm doing a deep dive in all these aspects. So this week, my guest, she is in the Superverse in the hit CW series Supergirl, where she plays Lillian Luthor, mom to Lex and Lena Luthor, actress Brenda Strong. She's going to be along in just a few minutes. And more information on those super guests later in the show. So you're going to want to check that out. You do not want to miss a moment of what is headed your way here on Comic Book Central. In addition to the super anniversaries that we're going to be celebrating all year long, as I mentioned, I've got the return of Flashback, Flash Forward February. That is my annual month-long tribute to the Scarlet Speedster. I'll be taking the show on the road for more surprises, so a lot of good stuff headed your way. But you longtime listeners know that, right? I mean, we always have the bestest time hanging out here in the lair. This is where the cool kids hang out. And I love when you folks share the lair. Bunch of you out there were sharing the teaser for this episode on social media already. So I appreciate that. Thank you for that. You listeners absolutely rock. Give the show a like on Facebook at facebook.com/comicbookcentralnetwork. Follow the show on Twitter at comicbookctrl. Links to those sites and a link to subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find them at the website comicbookcentral.net. As I mentioned, working on a search feature there so it can make finding some of those classic episodes easier. But if you check out the new platform for the show at blogtalkradio.com, if you've had a chance to check that out yet, Blog Talk Radio, they do have a search function there. So you can just type in the guest name. It takes you right to it there. So cool new platform for the show, blogtalkradio.com. Awesome lineup of podcasts there as well. So after you listen to Comic Book Central, you go back and check out some of those classic episodes. Take a look and see what else is out there. A lot of cool podcasts at Blog Talk Radio. So check it out. Super guest lined up today. Looking forward to talking about the Luthor family. First, take a listen to this, then I will be right back for an in-depth conversation with Brenda Strong. Born in Portland, Oregon, Brenda took an interest in performing at a very early age, went on to graduate from Arizona State University with a Bachelor in Music and Musical Theater, and in 1980, the statuesque Miss Strong was crowned Miss Arizona. TV guest spots followed in hit shows like St. Elsewhere, MacGyver, and Cheers, and a memorable appearance in Mel Brooks' Star Wars spoof, Spaceballs. And Brenda landed a choice role in the first season Star Trek The Next Generation episode, When the Bow Breaks. She showed up in the world of young Indiana Jones, returned to sci-fi and Starship Troopers, and made several appearances on Seinfeld as Elaine Bennis' nemesis, Sue Ellen Mischke. On one of Brenda's more famous roles, we barely even see her. On Desperate Housewives, she narrated her role as the recently deceased Mary Alice Young, commenting for 8 seasons on the goings-on at Wisteria Lane and picking up 2 Emmy nominations in the process. Now, last year on the hit CW series Supergirl, Brenda was introduced as Lillian Luthor, Lex and Lena's mom, leader of Project Cadmus, and determined to rid the Earth of aliens, especially a couple of well-known Kryptonians.
Supergirl. I don't believe we've been introduced.
I've seen you before. In Lena Luthor's office. What were you doing there?
I might ask you the same. I don't like the idea of you around my daughter.
You're Lillian Luthor. Lex and Lena's mother.
I'm a lot of things. A doctor, a patriot, a mother.
A liar, a kidnapper, a killer. Does Lena know about Cadmus? Does she know who her mother really is?
And what are you to my daughter?
I'm a friend.
Heard that before.
Now, celebrating Superman's 80th anniversary this year, and today, We're going to visit with a member of the Luthor family. My guest appeared last season on the hit CW show Supergirl as Lillian Luthor. Time to welcome in Brenda Strong. Brenda, welcome to Comic Book Central.
Well, thank you. I'm so happy to be part of this.
Part of Superman's 80th anniversary, man. You are part of the history now. This is so cool. Did you ever think you'd be part of Superman's history?
Crazy. No, I didn't. Although about 2 or 3 years ago, I had a meeting with my agents and I said, you know, I would love to be part of the superhero kind of lexicon. And when I said lexicon, I didn't really realize how close to that I was going to end up.
Wow. So, you had a good agent. They were paying attention.
Yeah. You know, I think when you're specific and you put it out there, the fans are incredible. And they're so dedicated, and I just thought, you know, after being part of Desperate Housewives and Seinfeld, you know, there's specific kind of fan groups that you go, these are great fans.
Yeah.
And I knew that comic book fans are, you know, part of that echelon.
When you're at a comic book convention, because I've seen you at a lot of comic book conventions and in different conventions, sci-fi and all these different things, you've done so much. I mean, you go back through your resume and we're going to talk about all these things, but there's like all these genre projects that you are affiliated with. And like you mentioned, even Seinfeld and, you know, they have their fans, Desperate Housewives have their fans. What do you get most of when you're at a convention? Because you get the table there, all the pictures laid off, fans are coming up. What are you asked about most?
You know, it varies. It depends actually on the part of the country. And I actually haven't done that many of them, to be honest. I've only done less than five. I've done a handful.
Oh, wow.
And depending, usually on the East Coast, I usually get Starship Troopers and Seinfeld. Midwest tends to lean more towards Desperate Housewives and Fear the Walking Dead. And I've only done one on the West Coast, and that was just kind of a free for all. At the table, everyone was from Spaceballs to Star Trek. What's fantastic is I do this game with myself, and when a fan walks up, I try to guess what they're going to respond to, just for fun.
Well, if they come up and they've got pointy ears on, you probably know where it's going to go, right? Like, that one's an easy one.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, for sure.
Supergirl
has definitely been up there in the last little bit since my appearance as Lillian Luthor. That's become quite a big hit.
You are firmly cemented in the world of superheroes now. I mean, okay, so I know for actors and actresses, they sometimes it could go either way. Like, they'll say, get me a superhero project, or some are like, you know what, keep me as far away from superhero projects as you can. What was it about what's going on now that sort of made you want to jump into this world of superheroes and the Arrowverse, if you will?
Well, you know, I've always been a fan of, I want to say fantasy, because I was a J.R.R. Tolkien fan. So I've always been a fan of kind of mythological characters, because I think even with Shakespeare, you know, we have these archetypes, and, you know, often with modern characters, we don't have the same depth that we can bring to roles. They're more circumstantially based. But when you step into a comic book universe, it's almost like anything is possible, but it's cemented and grounded in real kind of deep roots in humanity. And I think that's what appealed to me, is how can I take something that seems like it's otherworldly, like a comic book character, and bring it to life and make it real and make it grounded in something that I can personally relate to. So for me, it was kind of an exercise to see, you know, how I could do that. And Lillian Luthor definitely was a challenge in that regard. And I was excited to kind of get under her skin, because there's not a ton out there in the comic book world about Lillian Luthor, you know, and different iterations of the whole Superman, you know, story, whether it was in the movies or whether it was Smallville. You know, there's not a ton about Lillian in those expressions. So I was really kind of excited to see what I could bring to it that hadn't been brought in any other, you know, expression before.
That seems like it could go either way, because I've talked to a lot of people about this, and it's like, you know, you talk to somebody like Dean Cain or somebody that plays Superman, and there's so many versions of the character before them. There's so much homework that you can do. There's so much, you know, you can dig into and bring to it. Sometimes that's easy. Sometimes, you know, sometimes it's a blessing. Sometimes it's a curse, because it has been done before. With a character like this, there's really nothing, like you mentioned, to draw from. Maybe a few appearances in the comic books,
exactly.
Maybe a couple of shots on small. Is that, how does that make you feel as an actress approaching a role like that? Is it more like, oh no, how do I find out something? Or, oh, clean slate?
Oh, I think it's more clean slate. Obviously, I want to honor the tradition, but at the same time, not be limited by it. And the fact that it hasn't had a lot of air, this character, it gave me a lot of freedom. And so I kind of approached it more from a mythological standpoint. You know, the whole idea of Cadmus, I don't know if you know much about Cadmus as far as the Greek mythology of it, but he was the first Greek hero. And he actually was the prequel to Hercules. He was the one that went out and slayed monsters. So in a way, I thought, okay, so if I'm the head of Cadmus, that is really my mission, is to destroy what I perceive as the monsters, and that would be the alien life in Supergirl. So it started to give me kind of a more grounding in kind of Greek mythology, which I love. And one of the things that Cadmus slayed was a dragon. That was kind of his historic, you know, feat of defeat. It was slaying this huge dragon. And when I went and looked at the pictures, the dragon had kind of a serpentine tail in some of the art that's been depicted over the years of the Greek hero Cadmus. And so I started to incorporate in the very first episode with Glenn Winter that he directed, kind of a serpentine movement to Lillian. You'll notice that when she's kind of getting closer to her prey, like in that very first scene with Kyler, who plays Supergirl's sister, the actress Kyler, I circle around her. So I started developing some really interesting habits that to me had kind of a foundation in the mythology, but nobody else would know, you know?
Okay.
So it's fun to have a clean slate because you can make that stuff up.
Well, I'm interested in that because I always wonder with actors and actresses, they kind of, sometimes they'll tell the director something. Sometimes they'll say, can I do this? Is this okay? And then sometimes they'll just bring it in and not tell anybody. So that wasn't a conversation that you had with anybody? You just saw, like, let me see if I can work this in?
Yeah, I did. Nice. But then, because Glenn directed the first couple of episodes, we started really dancing together. And he loves to move the camera.
Yeah.
So we started actually establishing kind of a rhythm and a movement to Lillian that was different than anybody else.
Oh, wow.
And that was really fun because it was a collaboration. Oh, cool. And I said, you know, you know, it was like down the road because he had directed several episodes. I said, you know, and he went, oh my gosh, that's so cool. I love that. So, but he was definitely a collaborator in how can we bring this character to life without it being arch and unbelievable. And he was really interested in keeping her grounded, as was I. So I love that.
As an actor, that just has to get you so stoked to have a director that will work along with you and bring things in, as opposed to just look at, this is my vision, I got to get this done and move forward. Just do, you know, hit your mark and say your lines and move on.
Right, right. And I think, you know, I think in television, certainly more so than in film, actors who live with their characters are often deferred to by the director, because the directors usually are coming on more of a guest artist, and certainly with series regulars, and sometimes with recurring characters like mine, they're like, well, what do you want to do? So that's nice. In film, it's, you know, it's the auteur, it's the director's vision. But in television, often, you know, we've been living with our characters a lot longer than a lot of the directors have, and they really are, you know, deferential in what feels right to you, which I really appreciate. And sometimes I also like them bringing something to the table that I wouldn't have thought of. And it becomes definitely an escalation of fun in creating the vision, which is, you know, not easily done on a tight time schedule sometimes.
Well, you've mentioned that you're a fan of myth and fantasy and those types of things. As a kid growing up, Is that the genesis of that? Like, were you reading Tolkien as a kid? Were you watching, what kind of movies, what kind of books and things? Were you reading comic books at all?
I was reading all of Tolkien as a kid. In fact, that was kind of my, I think I must have read the entire series of books probably 9 times.
Whoa.
I did read comic books. I was much more, I can't remember which comic books I read. All I know is I had a cousin that had a barn full of them. And every summer we would go and we would just all grab a stack and start to read them. I think, you know, the Richie comic books, Riverdale comic books. Now they've, Richie Rich was kind of the one that, Archie is one of the ones that I remember reading more than the others because I liked the characters. But I think, you know, I think it's just part of that whole, your imagination. I didn't get to watch a lot of TV as a kid until Star Trek came on. And then I was hooked. I wanted to be in Star Trek. I just loved Captain Kirk. In fact, in grade school, we did a whole kind of parody on the playground with one of those climbing apparatuses. And I pretended to be Captain Kirk. But we would kind of make the names go off kilter. So instead of Captain Kirk, I was Captain Quirk. And instead of Spock, the character's name was Spook. And instead of totally, you know, we're 6 years old, 7 years old.
You were writing your own spoof. Yeah. You were writing your own.
Yeah, we
space
were.
Balls.
We were writing our own spoof. And even exactly. And that was just iconic that I got to work with Mel Brooks because I was a huge fan of The Graduate, but I digress. So when I was 6 years old, I was pretending to be Captain Kirk, not on that playground, but at home alone on my driveway, which had a 14-foot drop. And I was standing on top of a big boulder. And I was, you know, I was flying the Starship Enterprise and something happened. The boulder ended up going out from under me. I toppled down these 14 feet in this huge 100-pound boulder on my six-year-old little leg, cut my knee. And I had to get 26 stitches. So the very first time I ever worked with William Shatner, I thought, now's my chance. I can show him how dedicated I was as a fan. And so I showed him my scar in between takes on Boston Legal. Yeah, it was humiliating. But
so you got to tell him the story about playing Captain Kirk as a kid?
I did.
Wow.
I did.
I mean, like, was he cool with it? Yeah. Or was he just like, okay, whatever, I hear these all the time?
No, I mean, he does hear them all the time.
Yeah.
But I think any actor worth their salt loves being idolized.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we can't do this in a vacuum. We love knowing the people are watching. We love knowing the fans like our characters and, you know, look forward to seeing what we're going to do. So I think he was flattered. And at the same time, you know, I was 6 years old when this happened, and here's this adult woman telling him. So I'm sure that gave him a little pause as to how long ago that might have been.
Well, I'm sure he's cool with it now. Well, okay, so how does it
– Yeah.
Where did the interest in acting come from? So you're obviously play acting and doing all these things. Were you getting into school plays? Were you taking drama classes?
Yes. You know, it was kind of an interesting progression. I started – all of my siblings were musicians. My dad was a musician. My mom was a singer. So all of I'm one of six kids. So all of the children played instruments. And I thought, well, all of the instruments are taken and I don't want to compete with anyone else, but I really loved to dance. So I started taking dancing lessons and eventually dancing led me to productions of plays. I started choreographing for the musicals and then I ended up playing the Good Witch in a production of The Wizard of Oz my freshman year in high school and loved it. And then I went on to get the leads in high school musicals. And at that point, you know, I was a competitive tennis player and I thought, well, you know, I could become a literature teacher. I love Shakespeare. I love, you know, plays. I love language. I had no idea that becoming an actor was even part of my choice as a human being until Oregon Shakespeare came through and performed in front of us. And I thought, wait a minute, they're not in high school. These are adults. They're doing this for a living. And it occurred to me that I could actually pursue it as a career. And that's when I went to Arizona State and got a degree in in light opera and musical theater, and it was a triple degree in singing, acting, and dancing. And the irony, of course, is that I haven't ever gone to do Broadway and done musicals. I've gone straight to television and film, but I still love it.
Well, we're so glad you did, because you had so many roles. And you referenced a few of them. Look, I want to do a deeper dive into Supergirl and Lily and Luthor and the whole Luthor family. But you mentioned a couple
sure.
of these projects, and I definitely want to ask you about them. One of your first roles, if not your very first role, I think feature-wise, Spaceballs, which we 30th anniversary yeah. last year. I had a chance to talk to Daphne Zuniga about it. She's hopeful for a sequel. You know, we're all hopeful for a sequel. But okay, so how do you recall your first meeting with Mel Brooks?
Well, yes. I don't think I actually auditioned for him. I just ended up showing up on set. I think he approved me for whatever reason. And I ended up showing up on set, and we were all doing the, you know, the giving Daphne Zuniga back her old nose scene yeah. With the king. And we ended up shooting the master of that for like 3 days in a row. So he was just looking for funny. You know, he just kept letting us play, and we would riff off of one another and try to find where the scene, you know, would work the best. And during one of those 3 days, Mel and his wife took me out to lunch, and I was freaking out because, like I said, one of my favorite films was, you know, The Graduate. And so I thought I kept pinching myself under the table. Like, how did I get here? How did I get here in this movie with one of, you know, my idols, with this amazing, you know, comic genius, and this brilliant actress? And I just thought, I'm so lucky. And what happened is, after that film shoot, you know, it went on to become kind of the industry standard of comedy that it was. Two things happened of note. One is, my son came home one day from fifth grade and said, "Mom, were you in Spaceballs?" And I said, "Yeah." He goes, "Oh, all the boys in my class think you're hot. It's really stupid." And then the second thing
kid.
That happened was I felt so bad for him. The second thing that happened was, I was having lunch with my agent in Beverly Hills. This was just a couple of years ago. And Mel Brooks was out on the kind of outdoor patio area with a bunch of writer friends of his. And she says, "Oh, Brenda, there's Mel Brooks." And I said, "Oh, well, would you like to meet him?" And she went, "Really?" So I walked up to him. And, you know, this is years later. We're talking at least 30 years later. So I said, "Mr. Brooks, you probably don't remember me, but I want to say thank you, because you gave me one of my first kind of pivotal roles in film. And I've had such a lovely career since. And it's all, you know, attributed to that first experience with you." And he goes, "Who are you?" And I said, "I played Nurse Gretchen on Spaceballs." And then the light went on, and he went, "Oh, yeah. You were good."
Yeah. How can he forget that scene?
It just made my day. It was so sweet. I just, you know, he's a genius. And, you know, he's been a television icon for all his comedy writing and, you know, just all the films he's directed. So that was special. That was a good start.
Doesn't that just put everything into perspective for you? You know, you get your son and he's like, "My friends think you're hot. This is freaking me out." And then Mel Brooks, "Who are you?" It's just, it just tells you about Hollywood.
It really does. And it's really good to stay humble, because, you know, there's a whole bunch of people who have no clue who I am. My favorite moment for like that Hollywood star thing that keeps you grounded was, I was walking through Arclight in Sherman Oaks one day, and I was on my way to a movie, and I overheard these two men walking by me, and one said, "Oh my gosh, that's Brenda Strong." And the other one said, "Who?" And I thought, that's perfect. There's a certain, you know, collective of people who are diehard fans, and there's others who just don't even have a clue who I am.
And I think it's probably that, nice. You know, that, you know, she was, you know, Sue Ellen from Seinfeld? You know, I think most people might know
Misty, yeah.
Yeah, I think most people might know you by your characters, or, well, and you're, you know, for the most part, you're a disembodied voice on Desperate Housewives, so you don't get to see you all the time. Right. I think there's a couple appearances. A couple other real quick things I wanted to ask you about too, before we move on to Supergirl. Star Trek, another early role. So you mentioned Star Trek. Okay, so from playing Star Trek on the playground to actually being in the Star Trek universe, that and again, first season, brand new show, you know, all the hype coming around.
It was like the fourth episode or something.
Yeah, very early. What was it very like? What was your experience just being in that? Because this is like the return of Star Trek, the return of Roddenberry to TV. That had to be massive at that time.
It was. It absolutely was. And the thing, you know, there's magic afoot. I just have to say, you know, one of the reasons I think we all love comic books is I think those of us who are fans, we believe in magic. It's the same thing with the Tolkien series, magic. There's something afoot. There's forces, you know, at play. And I really feel that way about my career in a lot of circumstances, because the casting director of Star Trek The Next Generation, who cast me in that role of Rochelle of Aldea, gave me my first job. So I just feel like there's like, and then she ended up casting Desperate Housewives. So there's like this synchronicity all the way around, you know, of like there's a greater hand somehow. And I was pinching myself because, you know, being part of that Next Generation with Patrick Stewart as Captain Picard, I mean, come on. And nobody, you know, in this country, certainly at that point knew who he was. He was very respected in England. So, you know, and then it went on for years after that. But there's being part of something, a greater context, I think, allows you to feel really special. Because you know it lives on kind of in the zeitgeist, in people, multi-generations of people are Star Trek fans. It's not just here for seven seasons and gone. You know, it's this whole kind of wave of fans over across generations. So it was special for me.
Being such a fan of Shatner and Captain Kirk and that whole universe, and then coming on board the Enterprise with Patrick Stewart, I mean, what were your thoughts when you saw, because that... He couldn't be more the opposite of Kirk in that series.
Right, right. No, and he's a wonderful actor and wonderful to work with. You know, I certainly don't have any judgment of one to the other. I think everyone, you know, every single generation of Star Trek, whether it was Voyager or whatever, everyone had their unique kind of imprint of that universe. I just loved working with him as an actor to an actor. He was extremely generous and very warm on set to me. In fact, I went and saw him years later in Waiting for Godot with Ian McKellen, and he remembered me. I sent word backstage, and I said, it's Rochelle of Aldea, it's Brenda Strong, and he came out and spoke to us for a little while afterwards and was so, I mean, he's just so grounded and lovely and... you know, it's, you collect friends, you know, you're a fan first and then you become a friend kind of thing. And it just starts to evolve. And it's definitely, even just talking about it now, it gives me goosebumps because I think, you know, I'm still that young actress inside who's just so happy to walk onto Warner Brothers or Universal and be part of this history of movie making. So few of us get to do it, you know, I'm just really grateful.
So automatically, Patrick Stewart goes above Mel Brooks because he remembered who you were.
Now that's what you said.
That's what I heard. That's what I heard.
No, don't put words in my mouth.
I know. We love them all. We love them all. I also contribute segments to an Indiana Jones podcast. So I would be remiss if I did not ask you about your time in the world of Indiana Jones, as brief as it was. The Young Indiana Jones Chronicles, The Scandal of 1920.
Yeah.
Okay, so all these are historical figures coming into here. There's always like some foot in reality in this show. You're playing Beatrice Kaufman. What was your experience like in the world of George Lucas and Indiana Jones coming in? That had to be so cool, especially a period piece with the costumes and the cars and everything.
Oh, it was wonderful. It was wonderful. And to be part of such an important literary history in our country, in New York, getting to do real research on an actual character, I think it might have been one of the first that I got to do, where I had to research the actual person and try to glean certain things from her. So that was fun. I think, you know, being an actor is being a good detective. And I was obviously a fan of the genre, and it's my favorite ride at Disneyland. So it was very exciting to kind of do what would be considered a prequel to all of those films.
Yeah.
You know, I can't remember specifically, but I think it might have been the first time I had been in the South. We shot in around Charlotte and in near Atlanta. And wow. I think, you know, that was good for me because it felt like I was entering into a different world entirely, in a different part of our country's history. So it wasn't difficult to kind of imagine what it would have been like being back there. So it was wonderful. It was a wonderful experience. And costumes are always, you know, part of our armor as actors. It's kind of like for some, it's the beginning piece, and for some, it's the end piece that kind of makes everything click. So it was nice to be able to add that kind of to the coffer, so to speak.
Did you get to meet up with George Lucas at all?
No, he really wasn't. He wasn't on set.
Okay. It was always hit or miss on that show.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you may have talked to other actors where he was around, but I didn't get to work with him directly.
Okay.
But, you know, this was a highly educated woman who went to Wellesley in 1913. I mean, there's not a lot of women that went to Wellesley in the early teens, let alone, you know, wrote plays and edited and was a writer herself and was part of a collective of artists who were really on the forefront of women having a voice. I mean, she was considered one of the smartest and wittiest women in New York. So that was, you know, something to step into. That was really a pleasure and a little daunting, you know, because you can't meet the person. But you can certainly do as much as you can to do the research to see if you can bring them to life.
And even though you didn't get a chance to fulfill your dream of being on Broadway, you got to get close to Broadway because this, I mean, the whole show is themed around Broadway. Were you in and around the
right.
I'm trying to remember because it all culminates in this huge Broadway spectacular that Indy's producing. Were you around for mm-hmm. all of that, or was it mostly just sort of the dinner scenes?
It was mostly the dinner scenes.
Okay. That's what I was.
So we didn't do that, but actually I ended up performing at Lincoln Center, which was really lovely.
Well, there you go.
And I've. So, that's close.
Yes.
I'm hoping to go back at some point. It would be really lovely, to kind of step back foot. I have done some theater here in LA, which I've been really enjoying. So, eventually, you know.
Well, that would be very cool.
It would be great.
So you did get into the world of superheroes with Supergirl, the Nietzsche quoting mom of Lex and Lena Luthor. So obviously we talked about, you know, being able to do your homework. You've obviously did a deep dive into this. What did you want to bring to the character? Because like, did you research various Lexes? You know, because obviously TV, movies, Gene Hackman, you know, there's so much history with Lex as a character. Did you sort of look at any of that and see what the motivations were? Because she's so obsessed with Lex in the show.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. It wasn't until the flashback sequence, and I can't remember which episode it was. It was almost halfway through
episode 12,
where Lex was introduced. Yeah,
the Luthers.
It's almost halfway through. Exactly. That was the first time we saw any of Lillian's relationship to the young Lex and the young Lena, I think, which gave us a really good background of kind of her adoration of her son and, you know, the roots of her hurt around Lena, which is why, you know, there is that kind of push-pull relationship with the character of Lena, where she wants her love, she wants her acceptance, and at the same time, she's hurt by her very existence. So it's such a dynamic relationship with Katie McGrath and I, and we love working together. And I really think, and the reason I'm avoiding the Lex thing is, I really think this is more of an exploration of Lillian and Lena than it is Lillian and Lex. And yes, Lillian references Lex a lot as to her venom toward Superman and Supergirl and what they did, mostly what Superman did to Lex, and her justification for wanting revenge and to make them go back to where they came, basically, or to get at least get them off Earth since Krypton's gone. But I really think this is more of a mother-daughter exploration in this iteration of the Supergirl and Superman story. So I didn't feel like I had to pay homage to any particular version of Lex, although personally I loved Gene Hackman's. Kevin Spacey's was also interesting. But I didn't feel like I would be the mother of either of those two. So I allowed myself not to have to imagine that, because we haven't, other than the young actor playing Lex on our show, we haven't had to see the adult Lex. He's not part of this story. So I didn't feel like it was that important for me to delve into, you know, the research on any particular Lex that was played, but more my relationship with Lena and why that was so emotionally charged.
How do you approach playing the character?
Because she's fiercely protective.
Okay, that,
go ahead.
Well, that's what I'm curious about, because like, how do you approach the character? Do you, it's so interesting, because when you talk to actors and actresses who portray villains, quote-unquote villains, they always say you can't approach them as a villain because they think they're doing the right thing. And that's how, so how do you,
absolutely.
Okay, so how do you approach it and your relationship with, you know, Lillian's relationship with Lena of, like, as the actress, not necessarily on the page or what you've been told by the producers, but because obviously they're not going to give mm-hmm. you the whole arc yet. What do you feel her motivations are? Are they, you know, are they on the up and up, or is she trying to get something out of Lena, or how do you approach it?
Well, they're complicated. there's it's so interesting because I think every single villain inside, like you said so beautifully, thinks they're doing the right thing. And it really has to do with how committed you are to your mission. And I think the level of villainy comes from on a scale of 1 to 10, how committed you are to getting what you think is the right thing. And I think Lillian is probably in the upper echelon of a 9 or a 10 when it comes to her commitment to eradicate aliens from the Earth. I think she feels that that is the biggest threat to humanity. And she feels like, you know, they have also personally been the biggest threat to her family. And so I think on a micro and a macro level, she sees the damage of their presence on Earth. The micro level being her son and possibly daughter, and the macro being just the safety of the planet. And so I think she's very committed to carrying out the letter of human law. And this goes back to kind of what I was talking about in the beginning of our interview about the Greek hero Cadmus. Mm-hmm. One of the other things that Cadmus was kind of responsible for was creating letters. He was the first creator of the Phoenician alphabet. So in my mind, I kept thinking that Lillian believes that she is the letter of the law above any other law, that, you know, by creating Cadmus, she is creating the letter of the law and justice for what should be done. And so there is a purity in that. She doesn't think she's evil. She thinks that she more than anyone else can see what's going to happen, much like a lot of people feel about AI right now. Like, she can see what's coming down the road, and she's smart enough. She's a doctor. She's a scientist. She understands the threat to humanity. And so she very much commits, and her actions are to follow through on that commitment. And so when you say, how do you prepare? You choose your actions. So in every single scene, there's something active to do. And so that's how you kind of shape it. It's not about, you know, twisting a mustache. It's about getting what you want and what is in the way of what you want. And oftentimes in this particular season, season 2, what's in the way of what I want is Supergirl and sometimes Lena. So it's very frustrating and very complicated that someone who should be aligned with me is not. So there's the conflict, you know. And it's so beautiful the way the writers have, toward the end of season two, allowed Lillian to actually know who Supergirl is and that she's choosing not to tell Lena. Yeah. So there's a whole seed that's planted that could explode later with that information. So she's in a very powerful place at the end of season two, to do some damage to Supergirl and Lena's character.
It's brilliant writing. It's a brilliant performance on your part, because I never know what she's up to, because like even the scene where, you know, the handprint will unlock, you know, what she needs to have unlocked. And it's like, only a Luther could do this. And it's like, oh, that's why you wanted me in here, because you needed to use me for this.
Right,
it's like, well,
right.
Well, there's that, but there's also, I love you. You know what I'm like? Is it both, or is she lying, or like you? I'm yelling at the TV screen all the time. It's crazy.
Oh, I love that. I love that. You know, I do think she loves her.
Okay.
But I also think she's committed to getting what she wants, and sometimes that gets in the way of the love, and is hurtful to Lena. So that's the rub. I mean, the rub is yes, she loves her. She truthfully loves her, and is infuriated that she's not on my side and needs to still do what I need to do to get, you know, to get the aliens gone. So it's a very complex and deep, interesting power struggle between she, Lena, and Supergirl. So I think it's fun. I mean, I think it's fun to be on a female-centric show. I think it's really amazing in this day and age, with kind of this resurgence of women's strength and equality, to be on a show where the you know, number one on the call sheet is a dynamic, amazing, talented, and kind actress in Melissa Benoist. I mean, she really sets the bar for all of us. She works harder than anyone else. She never complains. And she embodies goodness in a way that's so organic and truthful. And it's just this particular cast, all the way from the top to the bottom, is so talented and so generous and so kind. It's just a pleasure. Every time they invite me back, I just have such a good time.
Well, that's one of the things you walked me into. One of the things I wanted to ask you about was, you know, with the success of Supergirl, with the success of Wonder Woman, the upcoming Captain Marvel movie, how do you think the success of these types of projects, these female-driven projects, are going to impact moving forward, possibly not only just in front of the camera, more females in front of the camera in lead roles, but directors, producers, writers, showrunners, female minorities?
I think it has a huge... Yeah, I think it has a huge impact all across the board that you just said, with women and minorities and behind the camera as well. You know, I've been working on 13 Reasons Why, season two, and we've had more female directors than we've had male. And that's changed.
Nice.
You know, I think it honestly started very much with Desperate Housewives, where there was a full cast of women who were the headliners of that series. And heretofore, before then, maybe Designing Women, maybe Golden Girls, but it hadn't been really like something that people thought to go to. It was usually the women were in support of the male characters, and usually, you know, by their side, but not independently on their own. So I'm sure there are other examples that I'm negating to mention, but those are the ones that are closest to me. So I think it's huge, and it actually gave me confidence this year to direct something. You know, I've had a lot of time in front of the camera, and I finally got behind the camera. I directed a short film this summer that I'm very passionate about.
I wanted to ask you about that. Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. So you're directing now.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, one can say that if you've directed, I guess you're directing now.
What kind of a director are you?
I'm ruthless. I'm Lillian Luther all over the place. I yell at people. I say, get me my coffee. I have a whip near my director's chair. Oh, I'm just ruthless. No. You know, I think like anything, when you're in a position of power, it just simply magnifies who you are. So I would hope that if you asked anyone who worked with me, they would say it was a lovely experience and that they felt it was very collaborative and that we all worked together for a common goal. I mean, that's really the tone I tried to set. And I had a couple of people on the camera crew who are vets who have been working in this industry a long time and who are amazingly gifted. And they came up to me at the end and they said, thank you. You actually reminded me of why I got into this business. You made me remember the artistry of it. It's not just a job. And that moved me so deeply. And I was so grateful and humbled that that was their experience. Because it really, I said in the very beginning, I said, look, I can't do this alone. Every single person on this set matters. And we're all in this together. So I did this thing where every day we did a appreciation and an acknowledgement. And we had this totem that represented the film. It was a little tank because it was a film about a military wife. And it would go from department to department. And people would acknowledge somebody who went above and beyond that day to make a difference to the set, whether it was extra hustle or, you know, saving somebody's butt on a certain, you know, shot or whatever it was. You know, it was just one of those things where, and all of a sudden it became a collective, and within 5 days it was a family. And I just love that about filmmaking. I love that you have that potential, that within a very short amount of time these people become so close. And it was magical for me. I don't, you know, you can never walk back your first film. This was my first experience as a director, and I hope to exceed it in experience, but it was a pretty good start. I really enjoyed the process.
How do we get to see it?
I was surprised, how much I enjoyed it.
How do we see it?
It's a short film. It's a short film. It'll end up running, hopefully, once I'm done editing, which I'm in the process of doing now, I'll start to submit it to film festivals. So eventually you may be able to see it online once we do our festival circuit, but it's a short film, and it's basically a calling card for me as a director.
And the name of it?
So it's called Number 3 Normandy Lane. Scotty Thompson is the lead. She was in 12 Monkeys, and I'm sure you know.
Oh, wow. Okay.
A little bit more about her career.
No, yeah. This is, I love the fact that there's, I mean, because, you know, you watch the Golden Globes and they make reference that, you know, like all the men are, or all the directors are men. And I just keep thinking there's probably going to be more opportunities to have nominated films by women when women are given a chance to direct the films in the first place. I mean, I think it's the cart and the horse thing. It's like they have to be given these opportunities.
Yeah. Well, Wonder Woman, look, it's one of the biggest grossing films of this last year.
Yes.
So guess what?
Yes.
That says a lot. You know, yes, it is giving opportunities to women, but also giving us a chance to succeed, you know, so that we can actually prove ourselves at the box office.
Setting them up for success as opposed to setting them up for failure.
Exactly.
Giving them, that's the point.
Exactly. Oh, I mean, look at Lady Bird. There's so many wonderful opportunities that both in independent film and hopefully now in studio driven films for people to show their talent and to step up and be acknowledged. My only regret is that I wasn't up for Wonder Woman. I loved being one of the Amazons alongside of Connie Nielsen who's actually a friend. So.
You're in the universe. I mean, you're in the superhero universe. You never know. Look, you mentioned Archie comics you loved. You're on the CW. You might be able to cross over to Riverdale. Who knows? That would be very cool.
And I
know you can't talk about season 3 of Supergirl. And we're coming in as we're recording this. We're coming in after the hiatus. We're coming into the second part of season 3. We haven't seen or heard anything from Lillian, right? I don't think there's been any reference.
No, there's no plans as of yet to have Lillian be part of season 3. Although I don't negate that there's an opportunity. You never know.
Okay.
Season 4, hopefully. But as of yet, there's no plans to have Lillian.
I can't imagine, because it's so cool. Because like this one scene I remember you were in. It was like we got to see Lex's battle suit. We got to see the atomic axe. We get to see all these like Luthor things.
All the play things, yeah.
Did they tell you what all those things were? Like, did you know, like, what the battle suit was? And
oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. No, our director on that episode in particular said, oh, this is so cool, because he's a fan. He's like, do you know what this is? This is so cool. So it was my introduction to it for the first time, but his enthusiasm definitely made me realize how important it was in, you know, the history of the comic book. So I definitely knew that uncovering some of those things were really important. And then the box that ended up, being the fix for the end of season 2 with the whole, you know, putting, putting Mon-El back in space and getting rid of the parents and all of that.
But we kind of didn't see what happened to her, though, right? Like, we didn't, it just, like, she just sneaked off somewhere? Or?
She just took credit and, yeah, she just took credit and disappeared.
Okay, I'm just making sure I'm not missing something here, because it's like, okay, I know, again, I know you can't talk about it, and we're going to see it back, it has to be. But if I gave you an opportunity, okay, put your director's hat on, put your writer's hat on, whatever. If I gave you an opportunity to, if the writer said, What would you like to see for the future of Lillian on the show? What do you want to do? What would you tell them? What would you want to do? Where do you want to take the character?
Oh, I think it would be amazing at some point if Lillian and Lena teamed up as kind of a joint arch nemesis. I think that would be a very powerful team. I love what Edge, Adrian Pazdar is doing with his character this season. I think that's a wonderful kind of balance to what Lillian did last season. And I think he's doing a great job kind of providing Lena something to push against. But eventually, I'm hoping she aligns with her Luther background and teams up with me. That's what I would want, is for us to take on Supergirl at some point. We'll see. I have no idea what their plans are. I'm sure they have many more ideas for what they want for the upcoming end of season 3 as well as season 4, because I'm sure they're planning a season 4. I say never say never. There's so many different ways this could go. And I think the show just keeps getting better. And the actors certainly are showing up and I'm enjoying it as a fan watching what they're doing in season 3. So it's fun.
Yeah, it is fun stuff. And look, it's Luthor centric. So we've seen the battles that we've seen all the, I think we're going to see all three Luthers together fighting, but who knows? It'd be cool if it happens.
You never know. I can never get enough of Katie McGrath. So
no, who could?
She and I adore each other.
She's amazing. Scenes together are so compelling.
So compelling.
It's just
electric.
How can fans find out about you on social media?
They can go to Instagram to Strong Brenda, or to Twitter. I think my handle is Brenda_Strong. But I have two different places, both Twitter and Instagram. And then finally on Facebook, there's a Brenda Strong fan page.
Okay. Well, when you and Katie get together again, or when you and Dean Cain hang out in Cadmus again, I'm sure we'll find out about it.
Yeah.
Brenda, I'm telling you what, we're looking forward to this. Of course, we're going to get more Lillian at some point. We know we're going to see her at some point again. So we're looking forward to that. We're looking forward to the Luthers. We're looking forward to seeing your short film and more directing from you. That would be awesome if we can get that too. So
you're so great. Thank you so much for chatting with me. It was really a pleasure.
Thank you for being on the show.
My pleasure. Take care.
Brenda Strong doing a deep dive into Greek mythology for her character. Man, how about that? You gotta love when an actor embraces the comic book world, like Cadmus, mainstay in DC Universe, and then works to bring something more to the table. You gotta love that. Even working it into the physicality of the character, that was something to hear about that too. Super stuff from Brenda there. My thanks to her for stopping by today to give us some insight into the mind of Lillian Luthor. I hope she returns to the show soon. I hope she's directing more. I hope she's doing so many more things. We're going to keep up with her on her social media pages to find out what she's up to. I will put the links to those pages in the show notes for this episode on my website, comicbookcentral.net, as well as the show notes for the episode on Blog Talk Radio. So check it out. Follow Brenda Strong on social media. We're going to follow her anywhere. All right, and be sure to follow Comic Book Central on social media as well. The links are on the website, comicbookcentral.net, Facebook, and Twitter. That is where you can support the show and share the lair. Share and retweet this episode to your comic book loving friends and family. You guys were already tweeting it out before, or just when I announced it before the episode aired, so I appreciate that. Tweet the actual episode out. Share it on Facebook. Tell your friends and family to subscribe to the show on iTunes if they haven't already. All of you out there, you're not going to want to miss a moment of the fun headed your way. February is going to be bringing you some flash-tastic Flash-themed episodes. I am days away from recording some more super goodness from the world of the Superboy television series. That's all I'm going to say about that for right now. Yeah, 30 years for that classic series this year. We're going to be celebrating the world of Superman in style. And more Superman goodness headed your way next week, because next week on Comic Book Central, as I mentioned, this is the 40th anniversary year of my favorite comic book movie about my favorite comic book character. Superman the movie hit screens in 1978. My guest, who's going to be here next week, he was there from the very beginning when producer Alexander Salkind famously said, "What is Superman?" Next week, the man who was behind the scenes of the flick, he was the fly on the wall. He was checking out every conversation on the movie, from folks hanging out at craft services to a 45-minute sit-down interview with Marlon Brando, the author of The Making of Superman the Movie, David M. Petrow. He was going to be here. He was behind the scenes. He was in front of the camera. Yeah, that's him with Clark and Smallville. And believe it or not, he was in the Kryptonian spacecraft. Why was he in the Kryptonian spacecraft? You're going to find out next week when I sit down with David M. Petrow. Until then, don't trust those Luthors with anything. Keep reading those comics, and thanks for joining me here in the lair. Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. This podcast is intended for entertainment and education purposes only. All original content of this podcast is the intellectual property of Comic Book Central and is licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivations, 3.0 imported license. All other content and names are registered trademarks and copyrights of the respective holders.
Helmets, you fiend! What's going on? What are you doing to my daughter?
Permit me to introduce the brilliant young plastic surgeon, Dr. Philip Schlotkin, the greatest nose job man in the entire universe and Beverly Hills.
Your Highness.
Nose job? I don't understand. She's already had a nose job. It was a sweet 16 present.
No, it's not what you think. It's much, much worse. If you do not give me the combination to the air shield, Dr. Schlotkin will give your daughter back her old nose!